Greetings, listeners. This is VK3OTN, the official station of the Radio Amateurs Old-Timers Club of Australia, with this month's news and information bulletin for members and friends of the club for August 2025. I am Andrew, a VK3 Charlie Alpha Hotel. Details on when to hear the news and information bulletins are available at the club's website, www.raotc.org.au. VK3OTN is available on a wide range of radio platforms, HF, VHF and UHF, along with 2-meter repeaters, amateur television, DMR, that is digital mobile radio, and D-Star. These news broadcasts are available for download for up to 6 months, just in case you missed the original news broadcast from the RAOTC website. Just put RAOTC into your favourite search engine. If you'd like to contact the club, then why not send us an email? Our address is raotc@raotc.org.au. I hope you enjoy this month's news broadcast. Welcome to the latest club news for August 2025. Perth Luncheons. The popular and well-attended monthly luncheon for RAOTC members and friends in and around Perth are held on the second Tuesday of each month. Please note the venue change. The new venue, 7 Mile Bar and Bistro, was a success with quite a few members turning up for a very enjoyable lunch and a chat for the July luncheon. The new location suited most of the members and the food and service were excellent. The vote was to return next month, so the venue was booked for Tuesday, the 12th of August. The 7 Mile Bar and Bistro is at 501 Wanneroo Road, Balcatta. Their website can easily be found by googling 7 Mile Bar and Bistro. In addition to the main menu, a seniors menu is also available. There is ample parking available in the adjacent car park. The venue is located on Wanneroo Road near the Reed Highway intersection and is readily accessible with car parking available. Since Wanneroo Road is a main thoroughfare for the northern suburbs, public transport via bus is also a viable alternative. The appropriate route and timetable information can be accessed from the TransPerth website. A copy of the URL is located on our website. Alasdair, a VK6ATX, is coordinating the lunch, and it would be appreciated if Alasdair could be notified of those planning to attend to ensure that adequate seating is provided. We look forward to seeing many of you at the August ROTC luncheon. Alasdair's email address is vk6kif@bigpond.com. I'll repeat that. Victor Kilo 6 Kilo India Foxtrot at bigpond.com. Overdue subscriptions. The last time I spoke to you in June, I drew your attention to the extra burden passed on to the membership officer and the cost of the reminder letters and follow-up letters sent via Australia Post. The additional postage costs have to be borne by the remaining members of the club who pay their dues in a timely fashion. Well, here's a teeny-weeny update to this information. Last time I checked in May, it cost $1.50 to buy a stamp and send a standard letter. Unfortunately, the RAOTC does not qualify for any type of concession that some older folk enjoy. It just pays the full rate. Because of the increased use of email that the majority of people use for pretty much everything, from business correspondence to utility bills, Australia Post carry significantly fewer letters than in past years, with many households receiving fewer than 2 letters per week. The cost of running the postal service hasn't gone down very much, and one area that Aussie Post has shaved a few pennies off is by making deliveries every 2 business days, and this may well become every 3rd day in the near future. Nonetheless, they lose money. However, as it's a government-owned enterprise, you and I pick up the bill. This resulted recently in an announcement that the cost of sending a standard letter will rise to $1.70 sometime in July. It's not really clear as yet as to how this will impact on the mailing out of OTN, but committee anticipates that this will go up. September OTN. Our editorial team has advised of what you can expect in the upcoming September edition of Old Timers News, or OTN, the club's twice yearly journal. Paul Edwards, VK7ZAJ, has written a great article about moving his station and downsizing his antennas at a new QTH, and Tim Robinson has written an article about the first radio transmission in Tasmania in 1901. There is also a detailed article by Justin Giles Clark, VK7TW, regarding Frederick Medhurst, one of the pioneer amateur radio operators in Tasmania. In 2023, Tasmania celebrated a centenary of organised amateur radio in VK7, which, amongst other things, recognised Medhurst's contribution to amateur radio in that state. Bill Roper, VK3BR, has an article on scanning and repairing early pre-word processor editions of OTN, and is also an interesting read. These archive editions of OTN are now also available from the download service for members only. This is a good time to remind you that purchasing the flash drive with all editions of OTN will provide hours of fun reading and provide an insight into the development of OTN over the years. You can then keep the flash drive up to date by downloading the colour editions of OTN hot off the press from the ROTC website. Invitation to prospective new members. For those listeners that aren't a member of ROTC, you can go to our website and download a sample copy of the club's journal, OTN, edition number 70. Simply go to www.raotc.org.au and click on Old Timers News in the main menu. Also, there is a sample copy of an article from the latest edition of OTN. And now, if you're not a member, you can see what you're missing out on. Melbourne September Luncheon and Hybrid AGM. The upcoming September Luncheon and Hybrid AGM will be held on September 18 at the Caulfield RSL here in Melbourne. It will be a two-course meal at a cost of $36 per head. Tea, coffee and hot chocolate will be included. Soft drinks, beer, wine and other drinks can be purchased from the bar. Details will be published in OTN and are available on the club's website www.ratc.org.au. If you see it on Instagram, X or Facebook, check with the details with the club's website or in the September OTN. Luncheon speaker. Peter Wolfenden, VK3RV, the WIA historian, will present an illustrated talk titled Wireless in the Sky, about early Australian airborne wireless activity. Peter will talk about some interesting and significant amateur radio history unknown to most of us from almost 100 years ago. It includes associations with early aeronautical wireless communication experiments together with the various techniques employed at the time. It provides a glance back at a few significant amateurs who contributed to the establishment of the first known wireless communication stations at Essendon Airfield, with the consequent involvement with an air race across Australia which attracted international entries. He'll also talk about the RAAF Wireless Reserve that formally came into existence about that time. It was an initiative of the WIA. New members and silent keys. Unfortunately, I have not been advised of any new members this month. I regret to inform you that Bill Jamieson, previously VK3 Hotel X-Ray, member number 1117, became a silent key on the 19th of June 2025. Let us pause a moment in memory of our departed colleague. And that's about all the club news we have for you this month.
You are listening to VK3OTN and Associated Relay Stations. VK3OTN is the official station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club, Australia Incorporated, with the monthly news and information bulletin for members and friends of the club.
This month we have a couple of interesting technical articles for you. First up is an article about former amateur radio magazine editor Bill Rice of EK3ABP, Maritime Mobile on Lake Eyre, with an introduction by Bill's son, Peter, who has taken over his dad's call sign of EK3ABP. This will be followed by an article about electrolytic capacitors read by Clive Wallace of EK6CSW. I hope you enjoy both of these articles. So now, let's hand the microphone over to Peter of EK3ABP.
Thanks, Andrew. This is Peter Rice, VK3ABP. Often, significant DX amateur radio transmissions occur due to ephemeral atmospheric conditions, but it's not often significant as due to them being broadcast from an ephemeral salt lake. Yet last month, on the 14th of May 2025, there was a 50th anniversary of just that, when my dad, Bill Rice, VK3ABP, now Silent Key, broadcast Maritime Mobile from a Red Baron catamaran under sail on Cutty Thunder, Lake Eyre North in 1975, on Arabana country in northern South Australia. It's sacred country. And, with permission granted by Arabana elders in 2008, where my Silent Key dad's ashes remain. Lake Eyre is currently receiving water from recent major flooding in northern Australia, but still may not fill to match the volume of water which was there in 1975. We can hope, despite restrictions on sailing and even going near the lake now. Let Bill tell you more from a QSO with Snow Campbell, VK3MR, also now Silent Key, in Melbourne, recorded on May the 14th, 1975, while sailing on Lake Eyre. You can hear water splashing against the hulls.
Yeah, Roger Snow, VK3 Mike Roger in Melbourne, VK3 Alpha Bravo Papa, VK3 Abel Baker Peter, Maritime Mobile 5 on Lake Eyre, returning. All okay, Snow. Your signal's readability 5, strength 9. We are underway, under sail, in Madigan Gulf, in the southeast corner of Lake Eyre at the present time. We have at least 10 feet of water underneath us, probably more than 10 feet of water underneath us, and making about 5 knots very, very nicely. Running about 50 watts peak, possibly not even that, using the mast off the boat as the antenna through a transmatch, and it's about a 20-foot mast, and using the lake water as a ground through a small ground electrode under one of the hulls. So that's the story, Snow. Name here is Bill, Bravo India Lima Lima. Bill is the name. And wonder how you copy there in Melbourne. VK3MR, VK3ABP, Maritime Mobile 5, Lake Eyre.
Video of that excerpt can be seen in a short film called On Air, EYRE, made at the time by Bill and Tim Robinson, VK3YBP, which also in May 2025 was accepted into the Australian National Film and Sound Archive. Tim Robinson has recently indicated to me that the film may also be possibly uploaded to the Digital Library of Amateur Radio Communications. It's sure not often that telephony of amateur radio communications is heard 50 years since first broadcast, let alone any from a boat once sailing on what is still, mostly even now, normally a dry salt lake clay pan. For RAOTC News, I am Peter Rice, VK3ABP. Back to you, Andrew.
You are listening to VK3OTN. VK3OTN is the official station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club, Australia, Incorporated, with the monthly news and information bulletin for members and friends of the club.
And now, over to Clive, VK6CSW, with a most interesting article he wrote for publication in a future issue of OTN magazine.
The electrolytic capacitor. Listeners will be familiar with electrolytic capacitors, but like me, may be unfamiliar with their origin and development. However, a little digging around offered some enlightenment, and I hope that you find the following of some interest. The main advantage of the electrolytic capacitor, or condensers as we once called them, is large capacitance with small bulk. Disadvantages are the necessity, in most cases, for correct polarisation and inability to work satisfactorily at high frequencies, restricting their use mainly to power supplies and audio frequencies, usually in a decoupling role. Conventional capacitors have two metallic plates separated by an insulating dielectric. The higher the dielectric constant, and the thinner that the dielectric can be made without electrical breakdown, the greater the capacity that can be achieved per unit volume. The secret of the electrolytic capacitor is that instead of using a bulk dielectric such as air, mica, or polymer film, etc., its dielectric depends upon the forming and maintaining of a microscopic metal oxide layer. The maintenance and the integrity of this layer depend upon the application of a correctly polarized DC voltage. Unless the capacitor is specially constructed as a non-polarized type, reversing the polarity or applying too high a voltage will cause the oxide film to break down or rupture, leading to failure. Many types of electrolytics use a wet chemistry and eventually fail as the water evaporates. Although there appears to be no clear inventor of the electrolytic capacitor, the principle was discovered by Carroll, otherwise known as Charles, Pollack. In 1886, as part of his research into the protection of aluminium and other metals by anodizing, he discovered that there was a very high capacitance between the aluminium and the electrolyte solution due to the thin layer of aluminium oxide formed. Unfortunately, once the electrolyzing voltage was removed, most electrolytes simply dissolved the oxide layer, but after much experimentation, Pollack found that sodium borate, or borax, would not of itself attack the oxide layer. 11 years later, in 1897, Pollack was granted a patent for the borax solution aluminium electrolytic condenser. The new technology was first used as starting capacitors for single-phase AC motors. Although most electrolytic capacitors are polarized, that is, they can only be operated with direct current, by separately anodizing aluminium plates and then interleaving them in a borax bath, it's possible to make a capacitor that can be used in AC systems. Today, we would refer to this as a bipolar or non-polarized electrolytic. Pollack's electrolytic condenser would not be of much use today. It was very bulky, built rather like a car battery, and needed topping up with distilled water from time to time. But a DC version of it was used in early telephone exchanges, where its large capacity helped to dampen the hash caused by relays. The usual power source for these exchanges was 48 volts DC, delivered from a bank of lead-acid accumulators, so polarizing the condensers was not a problem. The introduction of AC mains-powered wireless receivers in the late 1920s required smoothing condensers of around 4 microfarads and rated up to 500 volts working in order to minimize mains hum. Although these could be made using the aluminium foil with waxed paper or oiled silk dielectric technology commonly used for these small value condensers, condensers of this large capacity and high voltage rating were bulky and extremely expensive. In 1926, Julius Edgar Lilienfeld, an Austro-Hungarian physicist domiciled in America, designed the ancestor of the modern electrolytic condenser. After several years of experimental work, in 1931, he was granted a US patent for an electrolytic condenser. His design was similar in construction to the silver mica condenser of that era, but used layers of electrolyte-soaked paper in contact with aluminium foil in place of the mica dielectric. Sealing was inadequate, however, and the hot environment of valve receivers meant that these condensers quickly dried out and failed. A highly successful American mechanical and electrical engineer named Ralph Davenport Mershon, well known for his work in the design and manufacture of early high-voltage AC power generating and transmission systems, is generally credited with producing the first really successful radio electrolytic condenser. He became a master of the art of building capacitors, vitally important in power transmission systems, and also in radio electronics. Between 1911 and 1942, he was granted 55 patents. Around 1929, his Mershon condensers featured in the power supply of the popular Crossley brand radios, greatly suppressing the 60 Hz mains hum. The Mershon condenser was constructed like a conventional paper capacitor, made with two long strips of aluminium foil, interwound with strips of insulating paper, but with the paper saturated with electrolyte rather than wax. To overcome the need for perfect sealing to prevent the electrolyte drying out, Mershon fitted the capacitor inside an oversized copper or aluminium container, half-filled with extra electrolyte. Today, these wet electrolytics are prized collector's items. Unfortunately, poor seals led to a fairly short service life, and also the capacitors could not be left unenergized for long periods without deterioration. If left unused for more than a few months, the Mershons had to be reformed with a carefully controlled polarizing voltage. I'm sure that at least some listeners have tales to tell of dried out, exploding wet electrolytics, and many of us are familiar with the gentle art of reforming electrolytics. Nevertheless, although Mershon's idea was fundamentally sound, due to manufacturing difficulties, his company went bankrupt in the early 1930s and was bought up by Magnavox. The necessity for compact, dependable electrolytics in World War II electronic equipment brought about some serious research, culminating in a highly reliable product. A major advance was the process of etching and pre-anodizing the foil prior to assembly, and the use of less corrosive electrolytes, together with improved sealing techniques, allowing electrolytics a longer, unenergized shelf life without significant deterioration. Even so, it was a wise precaution to reform them, especially large capacity ones, by applying a small polarizing current for an hour or two prior to putting them into service. The development of gel and solid electrolytes further improved the capacitance per unit volume. Post-war, another increase in capacitance per unit volume was obtained by using porous, sintered aluminium pellets to increase the active area in contact with the electrolyte. However, during manufacture, the capacity tolerance of sintered types could not be as well controlled as the standard types using wet or dry electrolytes. In the early 1950s, Bell Laboratories saw that transistors, low-voltage circuits and miniaturization were the way of the future, and sought to develop a much more compact electrolytic capacitor. The result was the tantalum capacitor. Today, tantalum capacitor production consumes more than half the world's total production of this metal. Instead of chemically etching the foil, as was done in aluminium capacitors, the surface area of the tantalum was increased by compacting finely divided tantalum powder into a porous slug and then sintering the powder particles together at about 2000 degrees centigrade, while maintaining much of the slug's porosity. After sintering, the dielectric film was electrochemically grown onto the slug's internal and external surfaces, giving a compact element with a remarkably high surface area. Although the original tantalums used a wet electrolyte, this was soon replaced with a dry or solid one. For a given capacity and working voltage, a tantalum capacitor can be at least 3 times smaller than its aluminium counterpart. Further development has seen tantalum capacitors shrink even further, and very small surface mount devices components are now available. Tantalums are even less tolerant of reverse polarization than are aluminium types. If reverse polarized from a substantial current source, a tantalum may explode, catch fire, and release a cloud of white smoke. If, like me, you have experienced this, you'll know exactly what I mean. Today, 3 styles of tantalum are available: wet foil, wet anode, and solid anode. The wet foil type is made by a process similar to that of aluminium electrolytic capacitor production. These capacitors can withstand voltages of up to 300 volts DC. Packaged in tantalum cases, they are expensive and are used mainly for military, aerospace, and high reliability applications. Wet anode types are made from a porous tantalum pellet formed by pressing a mix of finely ground tantalum powder and binder in a mould and firing it at about 2000 degrees centigrade, as previously described. Sintering results in a sponge-like pellet with a large effective surface area onto which a thin film of tantalum oxide is grown and the electrolyte added. The package is usually a silver or tantalum metal case. The commonest type of tantalum is the solid anode type, also made from a porous pellet. A thin film of manganese dioxide, similar to the depolarizing agent used in dry batteries, is chemically deposited on the tantalum oxide dielectric and serves as a solid dielectric and cathode. Then a layer of carbon and conductive paint is applied to complete the cathode connection and the whole assembly encased in molded plastic or epoxy resin. These are the most popular and lowest cost tantalum capacitors, available with wire leads or as a leadless SMD chip package. They have very low leakage current and long service lives, but the very thin dielectric usually restricts the maximum working voltage to 50 volts DC. Many readers will recall the capacitor plague that began around the end of 2002 and lasted for a couple of years, caused by premature failure of a large number of wet, non-solid aluminium electrolytic capacitors of Taiwanese manufacture. High failure rates occurred in computer motherboards and other electronic equipment. A resurgence of the problem occurred in 2010, but as of 2013, the problem appears to have been rectified. In recent years, supercapacitors or ultracapacitors have become available. These electrochemical devices use an entirely new technology and are at present available in very small packages with capacities of up to 12 farads. They have a capacity to volume around 10,000 times that of aluminium electrolytic capacitors. As well as being used as memory backup and in other electronic applications, they're now being developed as energy storage devices in vehicle regenerative braking systems, including Motor Racing's Formula One kinetic energy recovery system used to boost racing car performance. Most likely, improved manufacturing techniques and new technologies will see highly reliable electrolytic capacitors with even greater capacities per unit volume created to meet the ever-increasing demand for miniaturization. But there's no doubt that the technology has come a long, long way since Pollack's chance discovery in 1886.
Thank you, Clive, for that very interesting item. You're listening to VK3OTN with the monthly news and information session.
It's customary to end this broadcast by telling a short, humorous story. So here's this month's offering. It's called Playing Golf. Jim decided to tie the knot with his longtime girlfriend. One evening, after the honeymoon, he was cleaning his golf shoes. His wife was standing there watching him. After a long period of silence, she finally spoke. "Honey, I've been thinking. Now that we're married, I think it's time you quit golfing. Maybe you should sell your golf clubs." Jim gets this horrified look on his face. She says, "Darling, what's wrong? For a moment there, you were sounding like my ex-wife." "Ex-wife," she screams. "I didn't know you were married before." "I wasn't."
That's all we have for you this month, and we hope you found something of interest. Thanks for being with us, and we hope you will join in the callbacks where callbacks are taken. The next IOTC news and information broadcast will take place on the first Monday of next month, on the same frequencies and at the same times as today, with the exception of January. If you have missed all a part of this broadcast, or you just want to listen to it again, it is available for download from the IOTC website. Simply go to www.raotc.org.au. Again, the website URL is www.raotc.org.au. Sometimes the relay station is an automated broadcast, for example, a repeater, where no operator is available to take callbacks. Other times the volunteer operator suffers from very heavy local queue iron, and callbacks are not always possible. Many operators need a small amount of time to switch from playing a recorded file to using a microphone. Please be mindful of this. This is VK3OTN signing clear from today's news and information session. 73 from the IOTC broadcast team.